John chapter 21, we're going to look at 17 verses, and before you freak out, you know I'm not going to expound on every verse, because you're looking at your watches going, oh Lord, 17 verses, we'll never get out of here. Well, we will. There's some key things we're going to look at in these texts. We're coming to the close. In fact, this morning is our last message out of the book of John, and I hope it's been a good journey as we've looked at the authentic Christ, who Jesus really is. Because if we get that wrong, if we get who Jesus is wrong, there's no salvation. Bible tells us there's no other name under heaven which man might be saved. But we have to have the right idea, the right truth of who Jesus is, realizing that he's more than just a teacher, and that he's more than just a healer, but that he is God in flesh. You know, last week we looked at Thomas after he finally got to see Jesus in his response, my Lord and my God. And as, say what you will about Thomas, he got it. And so that's our hope, that anybody that hears these messages, that read the book of John, they come to that understanding who Jesus is. And we're going to finish John with one more truth of who Jesus is. He is restorer. He is the one that restores. And as we finish, I want us not to finish the book of John with a whimper, but with a roar. A roar that screams loudly of the love and forgiveness of Jesus. No matter where you've been, no matter what you've done, Jesus still restores. He still brings people back to where we've always should have been. And that's what we're going to look at today. By his sovereign grace, God can bring good out of our failures and even out of our sins. J. Stuart Holden tells of an old Scottish mansion close to where he had his little summer home. The walls of one of the rooms were fitted with sketches made by a distinguished artist. The practice began after a pitcher of soda water was accidentally spilled on a freshly decorated wall, and it left an unsightly stain. Y'all, ladies, y'all know what that looks like, right? Drives you insane. At that time, a noted artist, Lord Landseer, was a guest in the house. And one day when the family went out to the moors, he stayed behind. And with a few masterful strokes of a piece of charcoal, that ugly spot became the outline of a beautiful waterfall, bordered by trees and wildlife. He turned that disfigured wall into one of the most successful depictions of Highland life. I think this morning is going to be a very powerful message, and I think there's some people that really need to hear this morning. The restoration that Jesus brings. Look with me in verses 1 through 3 of John 21. It says, after these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. That is the Sea of Galilee. Now you may ask the question, why do they call it the Sea of Tiberias if it's the Sea of Galilee? The Sea of Tiberias was called that because in the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, there was a town called Tiberias. It was named after an emperor. And so when a lot of people want to be on that part of the Sea of Galilee, they would say the Sea of Tiberias. Then you knew what location on the sea you would be at. So this is where they are. And he, being Jesus, manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, we talked about the twin last week, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. They said to him, we will also come with you. They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. What's amazing to me is after everything that happens in chapter 20, after they've found the resurrected Jesus found them and showed himself twice. First time, Thomas wasn't there. The second time, Jesus showed up purposefully to show himself to Thomas. With all that that's going on, they find themselves on the north of Galilee. Matthew 28:10-16, Jesus tells them to go there to North Galilee. It says, and Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go, take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me. But apparently, Jesus didn't show up when Peter thought he should. Or maybe they thought he had already ascended to the Father like he said he was going to. You ever had that thought? You pray and you ask Jesus to do something, and it doesn't seem like he listens, doesn't seem like he's there. And sometimes we go ahead and move on our own without waiting for the Lord to tell us what we've been praying for. We think we got it all figured out. Or we think we're not getting the answer we thought we should, and so we go and we do what's contrary to what the Lord would have had us do. That's Peter. Now here's the other issue. See, Peter decides that he's going to go fishing. He's going to go back to that which he knew before he met Jesus. Now that's important for us to grab, because many of us, we will have an interaction with Jesus, but we don't accept him as Lord yet. But we know he spoke to us. We know that he's grabbed us. And we'll begin to go to church and we'll begin to get into Bible studies. But because we've not really surrendered to the Lordship of Christ, what you will do is you will find yourself going back to what you knew before Jesus came to you. That's what Peter's done here. We got to be careful of that, because even as followers of Jesus, we could find ourselves back, going back to what we knew before Jesus, what Jesus took us from. And we don't want to be in that place. Now, the other thing is that when we decide to quit and give up, kind of like what Peter has done here, we will always, always take others with us. When you quit, when you give up, you'll take somebody with you, because they'll look at you and go, hey, I get why they did this. I think I'm going to quit too. That's dangerous in a church. When people who are called to a ministry and it's frustrating and you feel all alone, when you decide I quit, guess what? Those around you who are working with you will quit as well. It's just the nature of human. Peter says, I'm going fishing, and the rest of them go, hey, that sounds good. We'll go with you. They chose to follow Peter instead of waiting for Jesus. And what we see is that they fish all night long and they catch nothing. This is very similar to what we see in Luke 5, 4 through 6. We're going to get to that in just a minute. But further in chapter 21, verses 4 through 11, it says, but when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, children, you do not have any fish, do you? And they answered him, no. And he said to them, cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch. So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat. They had a little more common sense. For they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So when they got out on the land, look at what they saw. They saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have now caught." And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Now I want you to catch that the net was not torn. So what we see is as the day breaks, we see Jesus on the shore. But John tells us the disciples, they don't recognize him at first. I mean, they're only 100 yards away. That's really not that far. Most of you at 100 yards, I can tell who you are. But for some reason, they don't recognize Jesus. And as you can imagine, those same disciples are tired because fishing isn't like fishing today. They're throwing nets and they're hauling it and they're bringing it up. And so they're tired, they're hungry, and I got to believe they're frustrated. They got to be frustrated without catching fish. You ever gone on a fishing trip and never caught fish? It's frustrating. I'm throwing the same thing my buddy Kyle's throwing. I'm fishing it the exact same way my buddy Kyle's fishing it. He's catching 10, 12, 15 fish. I don't catch any. I get frustrated. And I've said this before. Do you know what his reply is to me? "You got a bad attitude." Well, if I'd catch a fish, I think my attitude would change. So here are these guys, they fished all night. They've not caught a thing. And now they have this person ask them a painful question. "Did you catch any fish?" Now, Jesus knew they hadn't caught a daggone thing. In fact, in the original language, the question was more like this: "You haven't caught any fish, have you?" Now, that's got to be embarrassing. To be professional fishermen and have to admit you haven't caught a thing all night. And this leads to a powerful point I want us to grab this morning, is that when we deliberately choose to be out of the Lord's will, we're never really going to be successful at anything. And you know what I'm talking about. Sometimes we try to do life on our own and we leave the Lord out of it, but we find ourselves continuing to be beaten down and things not going right in our lives. Well, why? Because you've deliberately taken yourself out of the Lord's will. You're never going to be successful as a follower of Jesus. You're never going to be successful when you deliberately choose to be out of the Lord's will. But on the other hand, when they were obedient, we see a great blessing occur. They listened to what the Lord had to say, and they obeyed. And when they did that, they were extremely blessed. And when the fish came up from the lake, from the sea, John knew right away who it had to be. And he cries out, "It is the Lord." We see where Peter puts on his clothes. He dives into the sea to swim to him. The others are a little more tactful, a little more common sense. They decide to take a smaller boat along with the fish they had caught. And when they arrive, they see, now catch this, I think we overlooked this. When they get there, they see that Jesus had already prepared breakfast for them. And what that tells me is that Jesus' love and compassion, once again, he's willing to serve them even though they're not where they're supposed to be. He makes them breakfast. Jesus then tells them to grab some of the fish they had caught. Now, for some reason, we are given the number caught at 153 fish. Now, there's several ideas why this number is used. We've never seen that number used. In the Luke's, when they caught the big number of fish and the nets begin to break, we don't see them count the fish then. But today, the fish is counted. The fish are counted. And it comes up with the number 153 fish. Man, I'd love to have a fishing day where I caught 153 fish. Wouldn't that be awesome? I'd be wore out, but it'd be a great wore out. Now, why do we have this number? Well, there's one theory. Now, this is really cool, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it's a theory that the people in that day, in the days of the ancients, believed that there were 153 different types of fish. That's what they believed. Now, if this is true, then maybe Jesus is teaching them that now they are fishers of men, there to catch every kind of man there is. Thought that's pretty good. Another thought is just maybe they had such a catch, they just wanted to see how many they caught. Dude, we've never made a catch like this. How many did we get? And here's the other theory. Maybe they were going to divide the fish amongst each other and they needed to know the number so they each got an equal share. Who knows? But whatever reason, we know there's 153 fish. And maybe they just wanted bragging rights. I've got friends that like to do that. Not going to mention any names. Also notice that the net was not torn. That's quite the contrast from Luke 5, 1 through 6, what I mentioned earlier. Luke 5, 1 through 6 says, "Now it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing on the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. But the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets, and he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land, and he sat down and he began teaching the people from the boat. Now, when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep sea, put out into the deep water, and let down your nets for a catch. And Simon answered and said, Master, we have worked all night and caught nothing." Does that sound familiar? He's worked all night and hasn't caught anything. "But I will do as you say and let down the nets." And when they had done this, when they had listened to Jesus, when they had done that which the Lord told them to do, bless you, they enclosed a great quantity of fish and their nets began to break. In Luke, they catch a great number. Notice their nets begin to break. But in John 21, when they catch a great number of fish, this time the nets don't break. Why not? It may have to do with the fact now that Jesus had completed what he had came for, the net that we cast will never break again. Verses 12 through 14, Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now, this is interesting. It says, none of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" Because I thought they knew who it was. But now that they're on the beach, sounds like they're still wondering who this may be, but they're not going to question it because it's got to be the Lord. And Jesus came and took the bread and he gave it to them and the fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he is raised from the dead. John gives us details that the other gospels leave out. These details are given to bolden our faith and to show that it's not some made-up story that just came from someone's imagination. Now, why do I say that? Because they're still having problems recognizing Jesus. Now, if I was making up a story, they would have known it was Jesus right away. Oh, there wouldn't be no question about it. I wouldn't want my readers to question it. If I'm making this up, everybody knows that's Jesus. Now, for some reason, they're still having a problem recognizing exactly. I mean, they know it's got to be the Lord, but for some reason, they're still questioning it. My idea is there's got to be something still about his appearance that keeps them guessing, even as they're right in front of him and hearing him speak. I mean, there's got to be something about him, his new body, that they're still struggling with connecting with who this is. Here's where it gets good. Verses 15 through 17, and this is really going to be the topic of our sermon. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." Verse 17. He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." What is the mark of a true follower of Jesus Christ? It isn't knowledge. It isn't somebody who knows the Bible. It's not even someone who attends church regularly. The true make of a follower of Christ is a deep love for our God. That's the true mark of a follower of Jesus. Deuteronomy 6:5 tells us, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." And you may say, "Well, that's the Old Testament, that were for the Jews." Okay. Matthew 22, verse 35 through 37. One of them, a lawyer, asked Jesus a question, testing him, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Then again in 1 Corinthians 16:22, Paul writes this, "Through the unction of the Holy Spirit, if anyone does not love the Lord, he is to be accursed." So we now see the seriousness of our love for the Lord. And I think it's a great time this morning for us to, in introspect, look at it in our very souls and ask ourselves, how much do we really love God? How much do we really love Him? Because the followers of Jesus Christ, we are called to love God. That is our call. That is the mark of a follower of Christ. That's why Jesus wants Peter to answer the question of his love for him. And Jesus asks Simon this question, do you love me more than these? What he's asking is, do you love me more than your boats? Do you love me more than your nets? Do you love me more than even your friends that are sitting around us right now? Brothers and sisters, we got to ask that question. Do we love God more than anything else in this world? Do we love Him more than our job? Some of you are going, "Well, that's an easy one." Okay. Do you love the Lord more than you love your spouse? Do you love the Lord more than you love your children? Oh, let's just get right down to the nitty-gritty and get tough. Do you love God more than your grandchildren? Because that's what we're called to. Now, if we're honest, we're going to struggle just like Peter does here. Luke 14:26 says, "And if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Now, of course, we know Jesus is not saying to literally hate our parents, because the commandment is to obey our parents. We do that out of love. But what he's saying is that nothing and no one can come before the love of our God. Understand, Jesus does not take Peter. Now, I want you to catch this. Jesus doesn't take Peter aside and ask him this question. See, the other disciples are sitting around in this around the same fire, eating the same meal. And Jesus asks him this question. Why would he do that? Well, Peter denied Jesus three times in front of all those who were standing around. He didn't have a problem in the thinking of his own hide to deny Jesus in front of all those that asked. And so Jesus is saying, if you had no problem denying me in front of people, then you better be able to say you love me in front of people. Mark 14:70 and 71 says, "But again he denied it, and after a little while the bystanders were again saying to Peter," get that, "bystanders were again saying to Peter, 'Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean too.' But he began to curse and swear, 'I do not know this man you are talking about.'" So now Peter is challenged of his love for the one he denied. Peter replied, "Of course, Lord, you know that I love you." And you would think, well, that settles it then, doesn't it? Jesus says, "Do you love me?" Peter goes, "Oh yeah, I love you." And that's the end of it. Here's the problem. The love Jesus asked about was agapao. It's the great love. It's the greatest of all loves. Peter's reply wasn't agapao, but it was phileo. Phileo is the kind of love that you have for a friend. So, do you love me greatly, Peter? Well, Lord, you know I love you as a friend. Even in that, Jesus says, "Tend my lambs." To tend is to pasture and feed livestock. And when Jesus says this, this is not a one and done, but it's a verb. It's to be a continual action. Listen, when we're called to follow Jesus Christ, it's not just the pastor that's called to tend the lambs. Every single one of us are called to tend the lambs. Well, who are the lambs? They're the vulnerable. They're the young ones. There are those who are new to the faith, though they're the ones that others may put aside. All of us are called to tend to them, to take them in and love them and teach them about Jesus and protect them. So he says, "Tend my lambs." Now, the most important part of this command is one word: my. They're my lambs. They belong to me, Jesus says. Listen, when people walk through the door of this church, they belong to Jesus Christ if they're a Christian. They don't belong to us. They belong to Jesus. And we ought to love one another, and we ought to love anybody the way Jesus would. Why? Because they belong to Him. They're not ours. We count people sitting in the pews Like that's something to brag about when we get a good number. Understand, none of this is ours. It all belongs to Jesus. Verse 16, Jesus asks the same question. Simon, do you agapao me? Again, Peter replies with, yes, Lord, I phileo, love you. And Jesus replies with the command to shepherd his sheep. Shepherding is synonymous for tending, and it points to the full scope of pastoral care. And that sheep are now the more mature. So Jesus is covering all of us, those that are young, those that are new in our faith. But we're also to tend those that are more mature. Been Christian for 120 years. We're still to take care of them. And Jesus asks a third time. Now what we know is it's the exact same amount of times Peter denied him. Jesus asks him about love, the same number that Peter denied him. This time when he, now this is interesting. This time when Jesus asks about Peter's love for him, Jesus doesn't use the word agapao. Jesus uses phileo, love. Jesus is bringing down the expectation of love to match where Peter is at. It's had to break Peter's heart. Because I think deep down he really wanted to love Jesus agapao, that great love. He just wasn't there. So Jesus brings his expectation down to where Peter's at when it comes to love. Now what's that say to us? There's some of you going, man, I want to love the Lord God. I know I just don't do a very good job about it. I know I let things get in the way of that. I know I let people get in the way of that. Understand this. You strive to love Jesus with all your heart and He'll meet you there. He'll come where that love, all that love that you can muster, even though it's flawed and it's failed and it doesn't quite get where Jesus wants it to be, He'll take what you give. And that's what he's telling Peter here. How do we know that? Because Jesus replies, tend my sheep. Jesus doesn't say, well, your love just isn't good enough, buddy. You should agape love me or agapao love me. But since you can't do that, I'm not reinstating you. I'm not giving you anything. But he doesn't do that. Jesus continues with Peter's reinstatement with the words, tend my sheep. So sometimes reading these words, sometimes the preaching don't quite get the emotion of this event. And so maybe this will help. I have a little video for you. Watch this.
Grace is God's unmerited favor for us, His crazy love. And the truth is, many times we struggle understanding it. If you find yourself struggling to understand God's grace, don't beat yourself up. Even the disciples struggled with understanding grace.
Jesus, is that you? You're alive! I can't believe you're alive! Okay, I was in the boat and I wasn't catching any fish, okay? But I heard this voice and the voice said, cast your net to the other side. And so I'm thinking, I'm a fisherman, I know what I'm doing, but I'm not catching any fish, you know? And so I throw that net over there and then a gaggle of fish pop into that net and I'm going, this is a total miracle. Who could have done that? I need to know who told me to throw the net to the other side. And boom, I look up and I mean, there is you. You're looking at me on the seashore going, it is I, the Lord, and you're alive. I can't believe you're alive. This is awesome. Andrew, get out of the boat. Come on.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
Yes, I love you. I love you. You're alive. This is so great.
Good. Then feed my sheep.
Andrew, get out of the boat. Come on, man. It's him.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
I love you. Yes. And I'm so sorry about that rooster clucking. I had no idea what that meant, but I do not. I'm better for it, all right? Okay.
Then feed my sheep.
Andrew, I'm smiling, but I'm serious. Come on, get out of the boat. It's him.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
Jesus, Mere words cannot describe the passion that I have for you. I love you. You know everything. I love you.
Good. Good. Then feed my sheep.
I didn't even know you had livestock. That is so like you, though. There's something new about you all the time. That's what I love about you.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you remember the morning the ladies went to the tomb?
Yeah. We're all in the upper room trying to figure out what to do next, you know, because we thought you were dead. You know, you were dead, you know, and we're trying to figure all that out, you know. And Mary comes running up, and Mary's like saying, beehive, beehive, beehive. And I'm thinking, I'm allergic to bees. Like, keep them out. You know what I'm saying? But as she kept getting closer, I heard her correctly. She was saying, he's alive, he's alive, he's alive. And we're going, who's alive, who's alive? And she said she was at the tomb, and the tomb was empty. And she said that there was an angel there. And the angel said, go tell the disciples and Peter that everything is okay, he is risen. And so me and John, we hightailed it down there. And if John says he beat me, he's totally lying, all right? I beat him, FYI, all right, you know? And we get down there, and I'm looking in that tomb, and it is empty. There's nothing in there, you know what I'm saying? And I'm like, what does this mean? What does this mean? And John is right there. John is so good with words. He should write a book. He is so good with words. And John said, don't you get it, Peter? This is everything Jesus said he was going to do, and you did it, and it's done. Let's go. This is so great.
Wait, the angel said what?
Go tell the disciples and Peter that everything is okay. He is risen. You've risen. Let's go. This
he
is.
He said what?
Go tell the disciples and Peter. Go tell the disciples and Peter. You said my name. Why did you say my name?
Peter, that's grace.
No, I don't deserve that, because that night people kept coming up to me asking me if I belonged to you, if I was with you, and I kept denying you left and right, all right? No, it'll take me my whole life to make up for what I did. It was unforgivable for what I did.
No. What I did on the cross was meant to take what is unforgivable and make it forgivable. That's my grace. It's not about you. It's always about me. That's grace, Peter.
Did that help give you a better picture of what really, maybe in more modern terms, it's not about our failure. It's not about our inability. It's always about Jesus. See, Jesus' love surpasses any of our failures. You think you failed miserably? Jesus' victory is far surpasses our failures. When we fall, when we fail, it's Jesus that comes looking for us. See, even though the disciples weren't where they were supposed to be, Jesus came looking for them. Mark 16:7, but go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. Nothing's changed. Jesus gives the same invitation. Come, and he'll meet you there.